the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for, yes, September the 1st, 2019. Yes, we're kicking off September today. Happy Labor Day weekend. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week and, I guess, the fall off to a great start.
Well, we won't rush it yet.
I'm in denial. No way.
Well, isn't it? I know it's not technically fall, but don't the weather forecasters and they consider this as the start of fall? Yeah,
meteorological fall.
Yes, that was the word I was looking for. It's too early fall. In the morning for me to be able
I'm
to
surprised
say a word
I came
like
up with it myself. But fall usually, you know, on just plain old calendars starts around September 20th, 21st. So you know, the summer really isn't quite over yet, and we're going to have temperatures in the 80s for tomorrow. Fairly nice day for a Labor Day holiday, and we should see temperatures in the upper 70s in the into the middle and later of the week. So that's not bad.
Well, it's hard for summer to end when we haven't really even had
one. We didn't really have a summer, yeah. I remember sitting in Millennium Park at the end of June with a fleece jacket on just because it was cold.
Well, you know,
just plain cold.
Like yesterday, so when I got up, it was, you know, kind of cool, and I put on kind of a sweatshirt, get downtown, sun was blazing, and I was like, oh, man. I'm overdressed, did some work, left work, sky was cloudy, and it was perfect weather for the sweatshirt. So we're going to be going through a lot of these things, I guess. But
yeah, ups and downs. It was windy the other day,
yes,
very windy.
Well, I'm you know, with Labor Day, I'm glad to hear that tomorrow is supposed to look really good. And I know today is supposed to, you know, eventually kind of clear
out. Yeah, this rain will move out. We had a fair amount of rain in the overnight hours, and just, you know, I think that is contributing to some of these accidents we've seen. And,
right.
Of course, you round that curve at Lakeshore Drive, we've had an accident at the Oak Street curve northbound. The slippery pavement, and you take that curve too fast, you're going to spin out. I've seen that three times this season.
And there's nowhere to go.
There's a lot of standing water. There was a lot of standing water on Lakeshore Drive when I was coming in this morning. There's some puddles in the right lane and the left.
A lot of people talking about a lot of standing water on the roads today. And I don't know why.
Yeah. I didn't realize it rained that hard.
It was raining fairly steadily overnight, and when I got in a little before 4 this morning, was not hard rain, but steady rain. So, you know, you would have some puddles as a result of the rain we had overnight.
Well, everybody just watch the roads out there. Let's be careful.
And the exceptionally high lake level doesn't help along Lakeshore Drive either.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. So, Shwani, what are you grilling for Labor Day?
I haven't decided yet. I will make the trip to Shwani Mart a little later.
Nice.
To see what's not on sale.
Right.
And
so that'll be,
we will figure out a Labor Day lunch.
5 day old what? at Shwani Mart?
Pork chops, maybe?
Oh,
I was wondering what the hours were for Shwani Mart this Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. It's 1 hour that they're open, right?
Right. 5 to 6 a.m.
There you go.
Get in line.
Oh,
I know. I'm not sure yet, Rick, what I'm going to do.
It's got to be seafood.
Seafood. You know, if I can find some good trout or some salmon, I'm always up for that. And the Shwani seasoning works out very well for that. So I'll be happy if I can get that done tomorrow afternoon. I have the afternoon free. I'm here again tomorrow morning, but tomorrow afternoon might take it easy and do some grilling. How about you?
I was debating about hauling out the smoker and doing some pulled pork.
Mm-hmm.
Debating that, because it is time-consuming.
Yeah.
To sit there and wait for the smoker.
I can attest to this. You do pork very well on the grill.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So, you know, and I have plenty of barbecue sauce from Murfreesboro, from 17th Street, that I brought back from the fair. So, looking forward to giving that a try. What are you doing, Andy?
We're going to go out on the 18th floor patio here and grill during the day tomorrow, because I'm going to be here most of the day. Do a little morning action tomorrow, and then a little pregame activity later on. So, we'll have to go. We'll have to step out. Oh, wait, we can't step outside.
I was going to ask you.
I was going to say, where is this patio?
Maybe we can use the. No, we can't do that either. That would be a fire hazard. I'm open to suggestions.
Oh.
We can't open the windows for any ventilation.
Nope, can't do that.
No, there's certainly. What can you do? Maybe just set up a Weber in the elevator.
Oh, there you go.
You know, that would work. The door's open. That would clear out the smoke.
Probably just stop the elevator.
No, you don't. You need the
airflow. You need the ventilator. Yeah, okay. Yes. I got you. I'm a little slow today, but I figured it out. Yeah.
Yes.
I got you.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, and we always have that patio.
Well, they have a fan in those elevators, and don't they?
You could time the cooking by what floor you're on.
Well, and for me, maybe we should go out on that little deck out there by the fire department, by the fire station there, just in case I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, actually, I've noticed they've got a grill outside.
Well, there you go. I'm going to go over there.
I mean, that'd probably be the safest thing
you're
for
right.
you.
Good point.
Let the experts handle it.
I'm all for that. I am all for that.
It leaves me in the clear.
Just don't call when there's a problem, okay? it does start feeling, I hate to say it, it's starting to feel like fall. And as we were talking in the newsroom, and Dave said, I don't mind the fall, I just mind what it
means.
We
know what's coming, though.
Yes, so.
You know what, though? Fall weather, autumn weather, when it's just a bit cooler, the humidity's down, isn't it great to cook outside, though?
Oh, it's the perfect.
It's the best, yeah.
Well, and, you know, hang outside, listening to baseball on the radio.
Yes.
I mean, it's great. It's great. I mean, that's what I'm going to be doing for the rest of this weekend. And, you know, after yesterday's opening of college football season, I mean.
Way too early, isn't it?
Doesn't it? But it was kind of good to see.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It is that harbinger of fall.
Andy, are we sounding a little grumpy here?
No, this is one of those seasons where there's just a lot going on right now.
The cross season.
And, it makes for a little bit of an adventure when you're trying to concentrate on one thing and there's a bunch of other things that are going on. You feel like you've missed out, and I don't like to miss out, especially when it comes to sports.
Well, and, you know, obviously first week of college football, and you didn't necessarily have stellar matchups.
No, and you don't really get those until you get into conference play anyway, or those independent games that kind of mean something when Notre Dame plays somebody. These are usually the ones that are set up for the favorites to win and continue their undefeated type of season.
But it doesn't always happen. Ask the folks in Tennessee.
Yep, and sometimes it takes three overtimes to win a game when you shouldn't need three overtimes to win a game.
I did not see the end of it. Iowa State, and they're ranked 25th.
Yeah, Iowa State and Northern Iowa.
Yeah, that should have been up in Ames, no less.
Yeah, you know, every once in a while, there's that Appalachian State game, you know, where ask the folks in Michigan from a few years ago.
Right.
There's every once in a while that kind of thing happens when you can't tackle during practices in camp, and it's, you know, these NCAA rules, and you get out there, and you haven't hit anybody since, I think I heard Ted Albrecht say this on the broadcast yesterday, you hadn't hit anybody since New Year's Eve.
True. True.
And then you get out there and you try to play a football game.
Well, I mean, I was a couple of takeaways was one of the Tennessee that they lost their to Georgia State.
Mm-hmm.
First time they've lost their home opener since 1983.
Yeah, that's a hard pill to swallow, especially there.
And they were 25-point favorites.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Man.
You had the interesting thing going on with Boise State. and Florida State moving the game from Jacksonville to Tallahassee because of fears over the hurricane. And Boise State mounts, I believe, an 18-point comeback.
Yeah, they were down. They looked like they were going to be left for dead there, and just all of a sudden came flying and storming back. That's a tough thing in that at an opening game if you get that huge lead, because you start to feel really good about yourself at that point, and you maybe let the foot off the gas a little bit, and I think that's what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, and then next week, Thursday, we start the Bears season.
Now that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I'm looking really, really forward to them getting that season underway, especially on a Thursday, packed house, Soldier Field, bright lights of the national television audience. Just don't repeat what you did last year at Lambeau, please.
Yeah,
hold the lead.
My gosh, how exciting was that?
That was crazy. You know, and today, by the way, is the 1 year anniversary of the Bears acquiring Khalil Mack from the Raiders.
Well, I think we've got good things ahead.
No, I agree. That defense is still very stout. New coordinator Chuck Pagano's got some great experience as a head coach and also a coordinator. Seems like the guys really love him, and I think he's going to actually play this defense a little more rambunctiously than maybe Vic Fangio would, because Fangio didn't like to send the house. He liked to send four guys, and that was pretty much about it. This guy is going to, as a pardon the old cliche of our former coach Dave Wanstead, they're going to fly around.
Which I think is fun.
I love it, too. I like to see that. Ball hawking and, you know, try to get to the quarterback.
Right, absolutely. Meanwhile, we have the St. Louis Cardinals, the dreaded St. Louis Cardinals, sweeping a doubleheader against Cincinnati yesterday to put us 2.5 games back.
2.5, yeah. Cubs got shut out at home yesterday by the Brewers. Just the second win that the Brewers have had at Wrigley this year. So that's
and it was two first-inning runs,
and that stood up. Cole Hamels didn't pitch badly.
No, but it was, let's face it,
yeah.
He gave up a leadoff double, and then he gave up two walks to load the bases.
Yeah, and the good news was Anthony Rizzo was back. He had a couple of hits, and now Ben Zobrist is going to be with the club. He was activated officially last night so that he can be on the postseason roster. You have to be on a roster before September 1st to be able to qualify for that. And David Bodie was sent out. And I'm not exactly sure the rule and how it applies with September 1 being the day that you can.
That's what I was wondering. Expanding roster.
40. Yeah, I'm not sure if he can come back. Usually it's usually 10 days, but the minor league seasons are ending this weekend and into tomorrow.
Except as I'm wearing my Iowa caucuses hat, because on Thursday, the iCubs, the AAA team in Des Moines, with a rehabbing catcher from the Cubs,
Wilson Contreras,
playing for them, the iCubs rebranded themselves as the Iowa Caucuses.
Nice.
And won the game, which put them in the playoffs.
That's pretty cool. And you know, the White Sox top affiliate, the Charlotte Knights, are battling it out with the Durham Bulls for the wild card spot in the International League. Charlotte won last night, Durham lost, so the Knights have a one game lead with two to play.
I like playoff time.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's great. It's great time because, you know, and it's in both of those cases, too. You're getting to see some of the top prospects that you're hoping to see at Wrigley Field and a guaranteed rate field very, very soon. And you're watching these guys get experience in what it's like to go through a pennant drive, what it's like to play pressure-filled games, even though it's AAA. I mean, that's where they are right now,
well,
right?
The pressure, yeah.
Exactly.
But, I mean, it's the pressure to perform. It's the pressure to win. And it's the pressure of trying to make the big time.
Yeah, and the other thing is that these guys are playing together, going through this all the same time. So you hope that when you bring these guys up together, they harken back to the days that they're playing for the championship of the AAA International League or Pacific Coast League or the whatever you call
the
it.
PCL.
PCL, yeah. That they change all the time anyway, you know.
PCL, not ACL.
Correct.
Okay.
MCL or UCL.
Yeah.
You hope that these guys have that same feeling when they get up together and they come up to the big leagues together, because they're not going to want to lose.
Right. Right. Instill it early. Mm-hmm. And
love that.
Let's see what happens.
Rick, can I jump in for just
please.
A second here? We have an update on Hurricane Dorian now. The Hurricane Center in Miami upgrading Dorian to a Category 5 storm now. This happening just a few moments ago. This could mean sustaining winds in excess of 160 miles an hour, and the storm now moving westward at 8 miles an hour. Devastating hurricane conditions, the word from the National Hurricane Center, can be expected. So once again, Hurricane Dorian now up to a Category 5 storm with 160-mile-an-hour winds moving west at 8. We will keep following this, definitely.
Yep. Feel free to break any time. Cat 5, that's deadly. That is just deadly. And we're still waiting to see where it may make landfall.
Right. And when. And the concern is the slow rate in which it's moving, which means prolonged effects. You know, the storm isn't moving quickly. You know, get it over with. This could linger for quite a while, and that would be even worse for those.
Wind and rain damage.
Yes.
Yes.
I saw that video yesterday of that weather plane that flew above the eye, and the eye is like 5 miles wide.
That eye is huge.
Yes. Well, our thoughts are with everybody down on the coast. That's for sure. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and also the latest in weather. Andy has our latest sports. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls. She's at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is grabbing wood chips for the smoker. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. Up ahead on the show, after the news and sports at 7:30, my Chicago Tribune colleague Hal Dardick will be back to join us. And Hal had a very interesting story that I want him to talk about. I'm not sure how much people caught up with this last Monday, but it deals with the massive Lincoln Yards development and how the tax increment financing deal was accomplished and perhaps why it was even kind of rushed. We'll have Hal explain all the details on that. We're going to get more news and sports at the top of the hour, and then we'll speak to my good friend Brian Bernadoni. He's the founder of Aurelius Public Affairs, and he'll recap Mayor Lori Lightfoot's State of the City address. And what do we know? What don't we know about the shape of the state's or the city's finances as we move forward? We'll get a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. She's recently announced a program to work with a group to identify tens of thousands of people who are eligible for expungement of their marijuana-related convictions as part of that new law legalizing cannabis on January 1st. We'll talk to her about that. We'll also speak to her about issues surrounding her reelection campaign. That's all up ahead. Right now, though, it's 7:30 on this Sunday morning.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Kind of launch our weekly spin through national politics. And we'll start with the president who was over in France for the G7. And he was basically bemoaning how much the job of being president has personally cost him.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've spent, and I think I will, in a combination of loss and opportunity, probably it'll cost me anywhere from $3 to $5 billion to be president. And the only thing I care about is this country. Couldn't care less, otherwise I wouldn't have done it. People have asked me, what do you think it costs? And between opportunity, not doing things, I used to get a lot of money to make speeches. Now I give speeches all the time. You know what I get? Zippo, and that's good. And I did a lot of great jobs and great deals that I don't do anymore, and I don't want to do them because the deals I'm making are great deals for the country, and that's to me much more important.
$3 billion to $5 billion it's costing him, and he doesn't get paid for speeches anymore. But then Trump went on to tout his Doral Resort property in Miami for the next G7 meeting. By the way, the Washington Post is reporting that the property isn't meeting its revenue goals for the Trump Organization. And, oh yeah, the president still owns Doral.
He'll probably be in Miami, right next to the international airport. Great location. It's a great place. It's got tremendous acreage, many hundreds of acres. So we can handle whatever happens. It's really, people are really liking it. Plus, it has buildings that have 50 to 70 units in them, so each delegation can have its own building. It's a very big, great conference facility. So we're thinking about it. They love the location of the hotel, and they also like the fact that it's right next to the airport for convenience. And it's Miami. Doral, Miami. So it's a great area.
That's the Trump Doral property in Miami. Over in Iowa, former Vice President Joe Biden launched his first TV ad last week, and it was kind of ironic. We remarked on it. It was one in which he didn't do any talking, which is somewhat surprising for the former vice president. Well, in his second ad, Biden is talking, and he says it's personal.
I was sworn into the United States Senate next to a hospital bed. My wife and daughter, they've been killed in a car crash. And lying in that bed were my two surviving little boys. I couldn't imagine what it would have been like if we didn't have the health care they needed immediately. 40 years later, one of those little boys, my son Beau, was diagnosed with terminal cancer and given only months to live. I can't fathom what would have happened if the insurance companies had said for the last 6 months of his life, you're on your own. The fact of the matter is, healthcare is personal to me. Obamacare is personal to me. When I see the president try to tear it down and others propose to replace it and start over, that's personal to me, too. We got to build on what we did because every American deserves affordable health care. I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
And that's the latest Biden ad that's playing over in Iowa, the first in the nation caucus state. Well, joining me now on the phone is my Chicago Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick, a member of the Chicago Tribune investigative team, a good friend, and also a great reporter. And Hal, thanks for joining me this morning.
I'm glad to be here, Rick.
I appreciate the story you had in last week's paper, the race to beat the clock on Lincoln Yards, and how a delay could have stopped the mega development from getting $1.3 billion in taxpayer money. Very well researched, very well written. Hal, let's take us back to the beginning here. You know, people hear the term Lincoln Yards. What are we talking about?
Yeah, Lincoln Yards is a 55-acre development that lies between affluent Lincoln Park and booming Bucktown, straddles the Chicago River, which is we all know, becoming increasingly an attraction in the city. And it was an old industrial area way back until the mid-19th century, but they rezoned it a couple years ago, allowing for not just industrial development, but, you know, all kinds of what they call mixed-use development, you know, residential, retail, commercial, hotels, entertainment venues, and things of that nature. So it's a mega development, as they like to say today, and these are becoming increasingly common in large cities like New York, particularly, and in Chicago, there's a couple on the boards. So it's just a huge development that's going to sort of transform that area. That's, you know, just a couple miles from the loop there.
It basically becomes almost its own community.
Oh yeah, it's going to add about 15,000. Residents when it's all built, assuming it all does get built as planned. It's going to have its own new metro stop. It's going to require new bridges over the river to get there. And it's going to have very tall buildings. That was a point of contention when this was going through the approval process at City Hall, and folks thought they were too tall. They did lower them somewhat. It's going to have its own set of parks. So it's really, I guess maybe not the best analogy, but it's sort of like plopping down a small suburb on an area that's ripe for development.
14.5 million square feet of office, residential, hotel, restaurant, retail, entertainment space, packed into 55 acres at a cost of $6 billion. So the developer of this wanted and said they had to have tax increment financing money. What's a TIF?
Yeah, a TIF is a way to use property tax money devoted strictly to the infrastructure within the area that's being developed. So at its most basic level, when a TIF is approved, the amount of money or the assessed value of the land upon which all the taxing districts, primarily the city and the schools, are getting their money stays the same for the next 23 years. But of course,
at the undeveloped assessment rate.
On the day they approve the TIF, so it's relatively a small amount of money that will grow dramatically over those 23 years. So the property taxes collected will go up by huge amounts of money. I think it's, if my memory serves, it's about, today they're collecting a little over $5 million from the area that's going to all those taxing agencies. And if the tax rate stays the same, they'll continue to collect that amount. But by year 23, when this thing's built out, and they plan on having it built out sooner, the taxes generated in there would be about $170 million. So the rest of that money, over $100 million a year in the later years, is going to go into this TIF fund, and then they're going to turn around and use it to build these bridges, metro station, subsidize park development, affordable housing, all within that TIF district. And it's, as you know, very, very controversial because the argument goes, well, you're giving it in areas that would develop otherwise, doesn't pass this sort of complicated but-for test.
And I want to bring that up about the but-for test, as well as kind of those complicated issues that resulted in the fact that, as the story says, truly why this thing got rushed. And we're going to talk about that after we take a quick break. We're speaking with Hal Dardick from the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Hal Dardick from the Chicago Tribune's investigative team. And Hal wrote a piece that you can find at chicagotribune.com about the TIF money and the relatively rapid approval of getting this project done for Lincoln Yards. And Hal, where we left off was the issue of, what constitutes a TIF, what qualifies it to be a TIF, and why did this kind of get accelerated beyond what we had heard when Mayor Lightfoot was talking about, this needs to go through her evaluation process.
Right. The way an area qualifies for a TIF, and it was designed back in the 1970s to redevelop industrial areas that were blighted and just wouldn't see development otherwise.
I think blight is pretty much the key component word.
It is. There are other kinds of TIF districts, but the original intent of TIF was to fix blighted areas, and you have to find that these areas are blighted and would not develop without the TIF district or but for the TIF district. So unless you created this, there wouldn't be any development in the area, so you have to subsidize it and pump money into their new infrastructure to help the developer afford the cost, and then you're going to create jobs and development and, you know, keep the city economically healthy. But over the years, particularly under the Daley administration, they were used in areas that you wouldn't consider blighted. Downtown Chicago is a primary example. The Sale Street TIF was very controversial. And people increasingly resisted them, believing that those areas would have developed anyway. So what you're doing is you're siphoning money into that area that otherwise would have gone to the schools, the city, and would have relieved the tax burden on the rest of the city. There is a lawsuit pending over Lincoln Yard saying, guess what, folks, we don't believe it met that but-for test and should never have been declared a TIF. And so I took a look at how this one qualified. It's a blighted area. There's in 1999, the state set 13 specific standards for the areas with buildings on them within the TIF district that had to be met. In this particular TIF, where they'd already rezoned and people were already going in and buying up land, particularly the developer that wants to do this development in Sterling Bay, and was it really blighted was the question. And in this case, it met five of those 13 standards, the bare minimum. And one of those standards was declining or lagging equalized assessed valuation or the value of the land used for taxing purposes in the area. And they took a look at 2013 through 2017 because those were the most recently available statistics. And so when they looked at that, they found that in the first 3 years of those years, that it did grow slower than the rest of the city. But in the last years, it grew at a rate, the assessed value did, twice that or more than twice that of the rest of the city. And the 2018 assessed values were nearly complete but not quite done at the time they approved this in April. And meanwhile, many candidates, and particularly now Mayor Lori Lightfoot, was saying this needs to wait until the next administration. There's too many questions. We don't know if the city is getting enough out of the developer. Sterling Bay needs to be more parkland, or the building's too tall. Do we need the TIF? But at the last minute, is the Emanuel administration just kept pushing this and pushing this. They got all the various approvals to the city council for Mayor Emanuel's last meeting in April. And then-elect Mayor Lightfoot is saying, this should wait. This should wait. And she says this, by my count, nine times in various press releases and public pronouncements. And then at the last minute, although the votes are there, and she delays, she's able to get the Emanuel administration to delay at the initial finance committee meeting, but it comes back in 2 days, and by that point, then-elect Mayor Lightfoot says, I've managed to get more minority and woman-owned contracting deals out of this TIF district, and I'm not crazy about it. We're going to let it. I'm not going to oppose it. No. And so it goes forward and gets voted in. Everyone thinks it's all getting sort of rushed through because former Mayor Emanuel wanted to burnish his legacy, as the guy that made Chicago boom again. But when I took a look at it, it was obvious to me pretty quickly that the assessed value issue would have disqualified it to be blighted if it had been delayed until the Lightfoot administration. And then I did it. Other than that initial impression, I did a far more complex set of calculations that showed, indeed, that's exactly what happened, and it would not have met this blighted standard. So it would have had to, once it started over, it never would have been able to be declared blighted and couldn't have been a TIF district. Now, they could have come back and said, well, we want to try and do a conservation district. They never did that analysis, so whether it would have met that standard, not what that standard says. Well, it's at risk of becoming blighted, and as many experts told me, that would be a much harder sell to folks to say, well, you know, is everybody's buying land up there for hundreds of millions of dollars, you're going to tell me it's
at risk.
Blighted.
Well, so bottom line, if they had waited, the new assessment's published, it knocks them out of the competition for being eligible for $1.3 billion in TIF funding.
That's exactly right.
Timing is everything in politics and show business.
Exactly.
Isn't that what they say, Hal?
It is. And the thing is, no one ever said this publicly. Actually later this week, some of the aldermen involved that really pushed it, Alderman Brian Hawkins in the Second Ward, Pat O'Connor, then the Finance Committee Chairman, said, you know, we didn't know about these assessed values, although, you know, neither really expressed surprise. And Mayor Lightfoot this week said, I didn't know that this was an issue. And I, you know, I have no reason to question that in any way. But you got to think, and nobody's said that was the case, but these are sophisticated people at City Hall and at Sterling Bay who had this study done. If they read it, they would have known that this was impending. So the public wasn't, you know, aware that this was going on, and it could have, you know, dramatically changed the debate, I would think.
Sure. Over 23 years of the TIF, the value of the land for taxing purposes is projected to grow from $87.4 million to $2.5 billion. And the capture of those increased taxes that won't be going to taxing authorities, but will be funneled back into basically a subsidy for development, $170 million each year. It's amazing. Hal, thank you so much for joining me this morning and explaining this. And it's a great read. And as I said, you can find it at chicagotribune.com. Thanks, Hal.
Yeah, thanks for having me and letting me actually have time to explain this thing.
It's not as complicated as it sounds, folks. That's for sure. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. U.S. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue was in Central Illinois for the Farm Progress Show. And despite documented concerns from farmers over President Trump's trade policies, tariffs, trade war with China, as well as new rules to cut back on ethanol, despite those farmers' concerns, well, Sonny Perdue says farmers are sticking with the president.
Are people anxious still? Are people hopeful and ready for a solution? Absolutely. But I don't know that I would use the word waning. I think, again, farmers are honest people. They want to deal with people who are honest. And for the most part, thank you very much. For the most part, I think they realize that China, not just in the last little bit, for a long time, has built their economy on the back of American innovation and creativity and entrepreneurship, and has stolen technology, has used that to build their economy, their military, and their goal of world dominance. And that's what President Trump has thrown the flag and said, you know, we're not going to allow that to happen. And I think farmers understand that. Farmers are long-term players. You don't just get into farming for this next season. There's nobody in and out of farming. It's a decision you make for the long term, and I think they understand that.
Yet the farmers are not happy. Take a look at what the various farm bureaus in the Midwest have been saying. They're not happy. And quite frankly, the new rules on ethanol are a slap in the face to the corn growers associations throughout the Midwest and forcing some ethanol businesses to shut down. That's what's going on out in agriculture out in the Midwest. Well, joining me right now here in the Skyline studio is my good friend Brian Bernadoni. He is the founder of Aurelius Public Affairs, part of that longtime government affairs specialist for the Realtors Association. Brian, thank you for joining me this morning.
Good morning. It's September, so that means it's Halloween Eve.
Okay. Here's our obligatory go for it.
Well, I mean, the giant claw was on yesterday. This is the great series of great movies you're going to find on Svengoolie on MeTV coming up. So this is you guys were talking about fall. I can't wait.
Thank you so much. Now we can move on to our regularly scheduled programming.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. And love Rich, too. But I wanted to talk to you because of the speech last week by Mayor Lightfoot, the state of the city speech that she gave. And I came on GN Radio after the speech and offered up my thoughts. I'll be glad to share those, too. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this.
Well, you know, I think when you watch the speech, her tone was direct. It was sobering. In parts, it was prosecutorial. She approached this messaging of how dire the fiscal situation of the city is in a tone that you can only say is foreboding. $838 million is a pretty big deficit in wake of the conversation about TIF and everything else. She made a very strong case that she inherited an absolute mess. She presented a very strong case that she was moving forward with a series of reforms. It was interesting to me that she didn't really call out anyone by name. I think she kind of adhered to
by inference.
Yeah, she adhered to the tradition. I think that Mayor Emanuel did as well by not calling out names. But there were several calls to action that I think she had in there about wanting to hear from the public. She outlined that a massive transfer tax increase, which I'm sure we can talk about. But she didn't mention some of the other taxes that I think are on the table. But in her own words, she said, everything's on the table. I'm not removing any kind of revenue sources from being part of the discussion. She also, I thought, made it very clear in her discussion of efficiencies that she was going after the status quo. I think that was a phrase that she was she adhered to, that the way the city has been run, there's a new sheriff in town, and I'm going to clean this up in order to get us out of the mess we're in.
That having been said, at $838 million, I think, in my view of the speech, was one that we know it's a mess, and it's nice to know now you can attach a figure to the mess, but we knew it was a mess, and that normally you look towards the political leaders to say, okay, here's how we're going to get out of it.
Big part of the speech that I thought was
lacking.
That
was the part that I missed those pages.
Yeah, that was a big part of the speech that I thought was lacking. I think, again, I used the word prosecutorial on purpose. I think she outlined the case of what's going on. But on the solution side, it not only were solutions...
Prosecutors normally recommend a sentence.
I think there is a sentence at the end of this thing.
Yeah, you know, well, that's what I mean.
There's a revenue enhancement aspect of this thing, but the solutions weren't spelled out. But to give her credit where credit's due, she's not going to lay those out until she announces her budget. I mean, that's when rubber hits the road, when the proposals are laid out and become very specific. That hasn't happened yet, but this is clearly a warning sign to the residents of the city of Chicago, the business community, and everyone else. And most importantly, I thought the message was clearly directed to Springfield. I need help, and I'm making a very, 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 very big ask.
But still, the lack of specificity on what she'd like to see, I mean, one, I think it reflected the fact that she hasn't had conversations with aldermen about what she wants to see. And two, she hasn't had conversations with Springfield about what she wants to see. I mean, remember back in May, when the end of the legislative session, she was down in Springfield in early May and talked about how she's got to hit the ground running because she knows there's time running out in this legislative session. And other than the casino, which was frankly going to happen anyway, and that's part of the capital bill, the Chicago casino. Other than that, you know, when I asked some high-ranking Democrats in Springfield about, well, what was the city's ask? The ask was, Well, make sure we don't get shorted on school funding. Make sure we're part of the capital bill.
Well, timing has changed. And again, I'm not part of the mayor's administration, but in defense of that, timing has changed. She has more information than she had when she first walked into office. And again, she spelled out, this is what the situation looks like. Let's call this the indictment. We're in the indictment phase. We're in the indictment phase of this budget.
Actually, we're the grand jury.
Yes, we're in the
indictment. We've been presented with the bill.
Yeah, this is the indictment. Yes. This is the indictment. But to go a step further, there are different audiences when you give a speech and different reactions. There's the reaction from members of the Illinois General Assembly, and a lot of them have already said, this is a heavy lift. This is probably not going to happen in veto session. This is probably not going to ultimately make a big difference in how she's going to fund fiscal year 2020. We're not going to be able to make that work. But the bigger thing is, how are you, if you're a bond trader, listening to this speech and not only hearing what the indictment looks like now, what the current fiscal situation, that $838 million bill that is sitting in front of you look like for the bond ratings, but she also made it really clear that she had another $600 million in pensions that she has to deal with in 2021 that are coming ahead. So I think in the midterm or the short, the, you know, however you want to call it, the long term, 2021 can happen immediately. But how are the bond traders looking at Chicago's bond rating going, okay, well, Emmanuel kind of brought some of the bond ratings up, but now do we have to reevaluate that whole situation and take a look at how much it's going to cost for Chicago to go to market? And at the end of the day, it's not just the city budget, but the mayor did not mention what's happening at the public schools and what that budget looks like. And that's a much bigger chunk of the budget than just the city of Chicago's portion. When you talk about the tax stack that an individual voter's property owner is going to have to deal with when they're talking about paying the bill.
We're speaking with Brian Bernadone, founder of Aurelius Public Affairs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. My in-studio guest is Brian Bernadone, founder of Aurelius Public Affairs. We're talking about Mayor Lightfoot's State of the City speech last week. And I guess, you know, Brian, I accept the fact that it's, you know, there are different audiences for the speech. But I wonder, I mean, it was a lot of, here's what I've done so far, which I expect kind of that. But it's, a politician leaves a void when they don't talk about what to do in the future. And I'm not sure I necessarily would have given this speech without having more substantive details in the transcript before she delivered it, where the line was what was going to be the deficit. It's the deficit is X because they had to, that's the surprise. But I expected her to say, and the deficit is X because X is a big number. I mean, we knew it was going to be a big number.
I think one of the things that you're seeing with a number, and maybe this is more of a macro analysis of it, but you're seeing with a lot of the newer politicians that are coming online that they're finding it a challenge to move from campaign mode into
governing.
And what we're seeing, I think, in this circumstance is a overwhelming problem being presented, a person who ran semi as a populist reaching out to the public saying, we want your input on what's going on. I think one of the texters had indicated that $800 million is not a huge budget when you look at a huge deficit when you look at the size of the city. But in reality, it depends on whose ox is getting gored on this thing. Mayor Lightfoot presented an extensive amount of social service programs that she wants to extend out. And she took some fines and fees off the table in this discussion as well. So she has some very fundamental give and take that she's got to figure out in a very short amount of time in front of a city council that is looking at her like every voter is looking at her going, okay, where are you going to find the money and where are the solutions? And while she doesn't have a huge amount of critics, the devil's in the details. You find that out during the budget process of where that's going to go. Rank and file is, you know, when you look at rank and file city employees, there's always going to be grumbling, but property taxes are something they pay as well, so they're going to be very loud and clear about it. I can speak with certainty that the realtors are going to oppose any opportunity to go down a transfer tax route. She in her proposal, she indicated that she wanted to cut transfer taxes on properties that sold for less than $500,000. As of today, that would be 15,000 properties that are on the market on realtor.com. Listeners can check that out themselves. But the amount of properties that she's putting the burden on transfer taxes moving forward, that would be properties that are over 500,000. There's only 4,200 properties in the city of Chicago selling for that amount. And when you talk about properties over a million, that's only 942 properties. So I think the idea that we're going to try and balance the budget on transfer taxes is not only silly, but it's also unstable. As we're talking in economic circles about the city, you know, we're in a pre-recession, some would argue, and in the top of the market, the properties over 500,000 are a slow-moving market and prices are dropping. So I think the city's going to have to take a look at those numbers carefully and reevaluate them before they shepherd their whole budget future on that particular one, especially if you're a homeless advocate, especially if you're a person who's looking for an option like that moving forward.
Well, she emphasized in her speech, you know, we must act quickly. We must move now. Here again, without any, you know, other than very limited concepts, spent, you know, a bunch of time talking about the casino. And we all know that issue of the casino tax and you know, trying to generate a new tax structure, basically, for what the General Assembly approved. But it wouldn't even affect the budget that she's talking about. So, I mean, why bother? We know Springfield's going to have to take a look at it, but it's not relevant to the conversation.
There's some agenda setting that's taking place. And, you know, you have to give a new mayor an opportunity to at least express what those opinions look like. I think Rich Miller had a very good article about this over the weekend, basically indicating there's probably better ways to do it than just a straight on announcement in a speech, you know, that you want to talk to leadership, you want to kind of work that thing through. But I think
that's my argument. Maybe you don't talk specifics because you haven't talked specifics to anybody.
But it's an important signal to the voters and to property owners. The problem is how that signal is being read. And from the business community standpoint, I think there's going to be a lot of apprehension. You don't know what the next series of taxes are going to look like. You don't know what the predictability factor of recruiting and economic development looks like. One of the things that the mayor spoke about was she wanted to build a growth strategy,
right?
A welcoming strategy to Chicago. I would tell the administration pretty cleanly that a welcoming strategy, a growth strategy, does not include stripping away equity from homeowners that are selling their properties or adding a welcome to Chicago property tax for people coming in. And that goes for business as well. I mean, the concept of the transfer tax has changed a couple of times, even since the idea has moved forward. Many states are getting rid of them. Chicago is going to become the highest transfer tax in the country with some of the proposals that are sitting. And I would remind listeners that as we stand right now, there are three different transfer tax proposals sitting in front of the city council as we speak that the mayor's probably going to move aside for her own proposals that she wants to move forward. But this idea of the stack, the idea that we're going to Governor Pritzker's progressive income tax, along with all these other taxes, aren't going to have an impact on how people with money, people who are portable, look at the city, I would question significantly.
A lot to look ahead for as we enter the spring veto session, and we'll see what happens there. I'm not optimistic that they're going to do much.
There's a big challenge there. I think we'd be remiss when we talk about Mayor Lightfoot to not at least acknowledge and mention the passing of Mike Bauer. He's a significant person in Chicago politics and actually national politics when it came to LGBTQ and that community. A warm-hearted man in a very brutal sport, which is Chicago politics, who guided and shepherded Mayor Lightfoot through the election. His passing is missed, I'm sure by her, but also by all of us that have been involved in politics in this town. My thoughts go out to his husband and partner, as well as to those who cared and adored him. His loss is significant within the community.
Ours as well. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the WGN Skyline studio, joined by Kim Fox, the state's attorney of Cook County. Madam State's Attorney, welcome to the Skyline studio.
Thank you. Thank you for the breathtaking views this morning.
And once again, we have to talk about them because it's radio, you know? It's, no, it is, even on a little overcast morning, yeah. It's still very stunning to look out over Lake Michigan and Navy Pier. I wanted to have you on this morning to talk about something that you announced last week, which is a significant step as part of the comprehensiveness of the new law that taking effect January 1st that legalizes adult use of cannabis. And that's the criminal justice component. Mm-hmm. As I said before we went on the air here, that you were, I think, in many respects, kind of a deal closer on this, because there were a lot of concerns about issues involving expungement and how this was going to be done, and does it go far enough, those kinds of things. My reading of the law, and this was one of my concerns, was the fact that when revenues start coming in, the first cut before the state would see any tax money would basically go to the reviews over records of expungement.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of seems like a pretty good win-win situation that you announced. Why don't you explain what this deal is?
So this deal is, we are working with the Non-For-Profit Code for America, who will come in and has the technological resources to be able to help us identify from ISP, Illinois State Police records, people who are eligible to have their records expunged. I think the difference in Illinois and the other places where legalization came to be was that we put this on the front end of the bill. People were legalizing marijuana and then trying to figure out what to do for past harms after the fact. And so the legislation recognized that for people who had convictions for 30 grams or less would have the ability to have those convictions vacated. Code for America coming in takes a lot of the heavy lift off of jurisdictions like Cook, which has a large population, by being able to go in and identify who those folks are, by generating the paperwork that's necessary for us to take into court, and then we then take the rest of that in and ask for these convictions to be vacated. And so it will allow what we would call automatic expungement without people having to come in, fill out paperwork,
file,
pay a fee, file. All of that effort will be taken on by the state's attorney's office.
Do we know how many people we're talking about here? Because I believe I saw statewide estimate of perhaps 700,000 people.
I think we're trying to get a clearer focus of that. The estimates that were bantied about in Springfield was about 770,000 records, and how many of those records are related to individuals. And so we've seen numbers that say it's about 300,000 individuals. Cook County, we estimate, has about 72% of the statewide records or people.
How long of a process is this?
Yeah, the beauty of Code for America is once we get the infrastructures hooked up where they can get the information from the Illinois State Police, they have the capacity to be able to review thousands of records within minutes. And so if you did not have the benefit of them, having to go pull the work, get the paperwork together, file it would be onerous in months. With their help, we're going to be able to do this far more expeditiously. And so we're going to get the first batch going in short order and be able to really estimate how quickly we're able to do it.
Why is expungement so important?
It's hugely important because the collateral consequences of a conviction have long-term effects. The ability to get a job. You know, there's a box on employment applications that asks, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Now, the research is clear that people who have those convictions are far less likely to get employment than someone who doesn't. The ability for young people, particularly when we talk about cannabis use, where people try it out in college and you get this arrest, to be able to get financial aid, to be able to get scholarships, the ability to get housing. So the collateral consequences are far-reaching. And now that it's going to be legal, you know, there are people like John Boehner who's going to make millions of dollars. I mentioned John Boehner.
The former Republican Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives.
That's right, who is now an investor in a major cannabis company, are going to be able to make millions of dollars off of this, while the young person who has, you know, precluded from being able to get scholarships or precluded to get a job has to be saddled with that conviction. And so it rights the ship. It doesn't feel just or equitable that something that
well,
is now
also,
legal.
Let's face it, too, the disproportionate people
Absolutely.
Of color aspect on this.
Listen, the war on drugs, make no mistake, had a devastating impact on poor communities of color, largely Black and Latino communities. And, you know, usage rates of marijuana are equal across populations. In Chicago, you were four times more likely, however, to be arrested and convicted for marijuana usage. And so it's finding a way to make it more equitable, to be able to say, now that this is legal, those who had been shut out before have an opportunity to participate and contribute to our tax base.
Well, and as I said, too, social justice component of this was vitally important.
Absolutely.
This wasn't just about tax money and lighting up legal weed.
Absolutely. I think, again, lessons learned throughout history about what happens when communities that have been devastated by government policy, and then, you know, we change that policy and other people get to flourish. And, you know, the social justice component isn't just to make us feel better, right? There is that it's fair and right. But I think all boats rise when we're able to allow people who've been locked out to be able to participate. And those neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that I see that are most devastated by violence, that are most devastated by economic disinvestment, are the same ones that I think will benefit the most by being able to have these records expunged.
How long of a time frame are we looking at?
So the law takes effect January 1st, and so that, you know, opens the
right.
the window. What we're trying to do now by announcing this partnership, working with Code for America, introducing them to the state police and other partners, is to get the mechanics worked out before that January 1st deadline. Our goal is to, as soon as the clock strikes midnight, to be able to start the first batch of these, because we know there are tens of thousands of them that we know we're going to have to touch. We want to get this done as quickly as possible.
Is there anything being set up in the court system for kind of an expungement court?
We've been talking. So I announced back in January, even before the legislation was fully developed, that the state's attorney's office was going to be seeking to vacate convictions in anticipation of possible legalization. So we sat down with Chief Judge Evans and discussed with him what that would look like. We sat with the clerk of the court, Dorothy Brown, and said, you know, what are the mechanics? And so those are ongoing conversations. They are committed to this work. And again, the hope is, and anticipation is, that by the time January 1st comes along, we'll be able to say, you know, that we have a call dedicated just to doing this work.
We're speaking with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the WGN Skyline studio with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. We were talking about the as part of the legalization of adult use cannabis, the issue of expungement of these low-level possession cases. I wanted to expand things a little bit, as I think you knew I would.
Yes, of course.
This has been an interesting time for you in the state's attorney's office. Already a number of people announcing to challenge you in the Democratic primary. About a week ago was the appointment of a special prosecutor in the Jesse Smollett case. looking back, do you have any regrets on how you handled this thing?
You know, we look forward to fully cooperating with the special prosecutor. He's reached out to our office already, and conversations have already begun. I think what I've always said is that if there are lessons to be learned for the way that this case was handled, we will absolutely learn them, adhere to them, and do better. I will always acknowledge that there's an opportunity for us to do better. But what I remind folks is that this is an office that handles about 40,000 felony cases a year, about 250,000 misdemeanor cases a year. And the dedicated men and women of the state's attorney's office handle everything from low-level offenses, but quite honestly are prioritizing violent crime in this county. And so, you know, we'll learn the lessons that this teaches us, but we'll continue to work on behalf of the people of Cook County to keep our community safe.
When people say how angry they are about this case and the fact that he claims to be exonerated, and that at one point you said, you know, you had the goods on him, and then we see the charges dropped. Understanding you said your priority was on violent crime, but nevertheless, there's also kind of that being a Chicagoan, having this rubbed in your face kind of matter. Especially among claims that this was worn by people who were Donald Trump supporters, which, if you wanted to, you know, cast a wide net in Chicago, it wouldn't be too hard to find the people wearing MAGA hats. But I mean, when people are get kind of viscerally angry, what do you tell them?
Listen, I'm a lifelong Chicagoan too, and I wear my Chicago pride just as everyone else. But I run a criminal justice system that has seen far too many people in our system for nonviolent offenses, while those who are wreaking havoc on communities where, you know, children can't go out to play, the elders, you know, we had a man a couple years ago who was shot and killed in his front lawn mowing his grass. That's where our focus is. And so I understand the vitriol and the ire, and I certainly want to continue to have people have trust in the justice system and how we treat people.
But you know, this has raised issues of trust.
Yes. And which is why, from the very beginning, we have said that we welcomed a non-political review of how we've done this work. I said that in the first week, and I continue to say that now, because trust is paramount for us to be able to do this work. It's how we're able to increase conviction rates while people feel comfortable coming and cooperating with us. It's also allowed us to talk about, you know, how our office operates, how we treat folks who are charged with nonviolent low-level offenses. You know, we have one of the largest expansions in our diversion programs, where we deal with cases that could be dealt with in the court system outside of the court system. In this year alone, we've diverted more people away from the criminal justice system than we did in all of 2016, and we're just in the third quarter. And so these are conversations that, while sparked by anger and curiosity and frustration, that I think allows for us to talk about what is it that we're trying to do with the justice system? How are we trying to use our limited resources, particularly in a county that's been ravaged by violence?
Is that message getting across, though?
You know, I think it takes continually talking about it.
I mean, just given kind of the unique nature of this case.
Yeah, I think the more we talk about it, the message gets across. I've yet to go anywhere where people would say that we don't have a violent crime problem, or would say that the allegations in this particular case were stupid and frustrating, but didn't merit, say, a prison sentence. And what's that space in between? And so I think being able to talk about it, being able to answer the questions about what we do, why we do, how we do it, the message comes across. But we have a lot of work to do. I think there was a lot of continual coverage of this and a lot of confusion. And again, the responsibility is not on the public. It is on me as an elected official to be able to tell who we are, what we are, and why we do what we do.
Well, and that's certainly part of the reelect campaign.
That's right. That's right.
And you do have the Democratic endorsement. But yet people are, I mean, the number of candidates who are looking or who have announced, they feel that there's a vulnerability here.
Listen, I think if we were talking about one issue, that perhaps that gives someone a sense of, hey, I can do this. But if we expand and talk about the fact that our Conviction Integrity Unit is a national model right now, a couple years ago, the sad reality was Cook County was known as the false confession capital of the United States. In the last 2.5 years, we have vacated the convictions of almost 80 people who were wrongfully convicted. If we talk about the strategic ways in which we've been dealing with gun violence, the police superintendent just announced today that gun violence and homicides have continued to go down. All the reforms that we've been doing since December of 2016 has helped us be able to focus our attention on violence. Our Gun Crime Strategies Unit is the first of its kind here in Cook County, where we took attorneys out of the courtroom, put them in our most violent police districts, working with CPD, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the FBI. And our convictions around the drivers of violence have continued to skyrocket. And so I get very excited about the fact that, you know, we're the most transparent office in the country, the first prosecutor's office in the country who put every bit of case level data of felonies on our open data portal. So when people ask me, hey, I think you treated this person different than you treated someone else, they have the access and ability to go to our website and look and see, how do we treat people with class 4 felonies? How do we treat people, say, with disorderly conduct? So you can look at that. And so the full record, the full breadth of what we've been able to do here and the results make me very excited to engage in the conversation with anybody who's willing to have it, whether on the campaign trail or in the community.
That's Kim Fox. She is the Cook County State's Attorney. Madam Prosecutor, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.